I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, go to our website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner, or check out the link in the description below. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we're going to have part two of our interview with Jerry Branum, where we're talking about the history of the Mr. Olympia. This year, they're going to have the 60th Mr. Olympia. The contest started in 1965. So Jerry and I started last week talking about the history of the Mr. Olympia. And last week, we talked about the Bud Parker era, which was when the Mr. Olympia first began, and it was held at the Brooklyn Academy of Music from 1965 to 1969. And we also talked about the Arnold era, which was Arnold's reign as Mr. Olympia, which lasted from 1970 to 1975. So today we're going to continue that discussion, and we're going to talk about the Columbus years. And this was the years when Arnold and Jim Lorimer were promoting the Mr. Olympia, and they promoted it from 1976 to 1979. And Franco won it the first year in 1976, and then Frank Zane won his three Mr. Olympias in Columbus. And then the next year I came up with is the controversial years. And of course, that's 1980 and 1981, when Arnold came back after a five-year retirement and he won the Mr. Olympia in 1980. And then Franco did the same thing in 1981, coming back from a five-year retirement and winning the contest in 1981. And then finally, we'll talk about the next 2 years, which was 1982 and 1983, when Chris Dickerson and Samir Banute won. And then we'll leave the Lee Haney years and the Dorian Yates years and all the mass monster eras. We'll leave that for next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast when we finish our discussion of the Mr. Olympia history. All right. How are you guys doing out there? I hope you're enjoying your summer. It's going by fast. We're already into August. They had the Texas Pro show yesterday, and I want to mention that because I know a lot of you guys are into the history of bodybuilding and follow like the older days, but many of you may not follow what's going on in modern bodybuilding. But there's a bodybuilder named Andrew Jacked who's been around the last couple of years. That's not his real name. I think he's from Nigeria, and he has an African last name, but they always call him Andrew Jacked, and he is an incredible physique. He's my favorite bodybuilder that's competing on the pro level right now because he's got a very symmetrical physique despite his massive size. He's very tall. He's about 6'1", 6'2". So he towers over most of the other bodybuilders, but he's still got a very small waist. He's got incredible abs, like an eight pack abs, but just great symmetry and great shape to his physique. And I always liked him since he came out a couple of years ago. But now his criticism from last year when he competed in the Mr. Olympia from the judges was that he's not big enough because he's just so tall and his limbs are so long. So he spent many months in the off season putting on size, and this guy is absolutely incredible. So I'm very excited to see how he'll do at the Mr. Olympia in a couple months. I hope they give him the recognition he deserves because I think he's the best bodybuilder out there. And if he comes in top shape, which I think with his new progress he's made, he will come in top shape. And he's working with Chris Aceto, who of course is a great contest prep coach. I think Andrew is really going to have a great year this year. So fingers crossed that he does well. This guy looks like what Mr. Olympia should look like, in my opinion. So hopefully he'll do really, really well. So that was exciting to see. I was waiting to see what he looked like. I've got some emails here that I'm going to read in a second. And then this interview I did with Jerry on part two, it's kind of short. I think it's under 40 minutes. So at the end of the interview, I'm going to read some magazines. I know some of you guys like me reading the magazine. Some of you don't. So I got three articles I want to read, and it will pertain to the contest that we're going to talk about today. The first one will be from the 1979 Mr. Olympia. It was an article written by Gary Bartlett, and it was in the May 1980 issue, I believe, of Muscle and Fitness magazine. And it was called In Defense of Zane, because some people were criticizing Zane for beating Mike Mentzer in 1979, because Mike scored a 300 perfect score in the prejudging, and then he was beat by Zane in the pose down. So Gary Bartlett wrote this article that kind of became famous later on called In Defense of Zane. And I think this was the first time Gary, who is a photographer from Canada, I think this was the first time he really got like some mainstream coverage getting an article in Muscle and Fitness. And then I want to read another article about the 1981 Mr. Olympia. This was actually from Iron Man magazine from March 1982. And they had the original article, the original contest report, in the previous month in the January issue. But then in the March issue, Steven Robinson, who used to write some articles for Iron Man, he wrote an article that said how I saw the Mr. Olympia and the top six men. So it's like another viewpoint of the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So I thought I would read that as well. And then I want to finish with the very famous Jack Neary report of the 1980 Mr. Olympia, which I think I may have read on the show before, but I thought I would repeat it here since we are talking about the 1980 Olympia again. This was a very famous article by Jack Neary, probably his most famous article he ever did. It's called Olympia Report, Arnold's Victory Creates Controversy and Bitterness. So this was really the first article that came out that reported that Arnold's win was very controversial, because the month before they had done a flash report and it just said that Arnold won and they just had a couple pictures. I think it was only like a half a page report, but this one really exposed what really went on. And it's really kind of grown in fame, I guess, over the years, since this was 44 years ago that the contest took place. So I'm going to read those articles right after we get done with our interview with Jerry. All right, before we get to that, though, I did get some emails from you guys, so I wanted to read them first. This one says, "Hey, John, I've been a devoted fan of your podcast since its debut in 2017. Listening to your recent podcast, The History of the Mr. Olympia Part 1, I was appalled by the senseless and cowardly email you received, John, which you read on the air with dignity and humility. I'm amazed how composed and humble you were, John, as you read out those cowardly criticisms made by the contemptuous emailer. The dignity and virtue of your character, John, in the face of gutless adversity is admirable and awe-inspiring. I'm personally grateful for any podcast you can release, considering how much time and effort must be made in searching for prospective interviewees or content to discuss. Over the years, John, you personally sustained my interest and passion for bodybuilding with the many videos you release on YouTube, as well as the many anecdotes you discuss with your guests, especially Jerry Branum. Keep up the admirable work, John. You're truly one of the most devoted golden era bastions remaining. All the best, too, with your prospective new book on the history of bodybuilding. Best regards from Down Under in Australia, Peter Schuler." All right, Peter, thank you very much for coming to my defense for that email last week. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you listening to the show since 2017. That's awesome. This one says, "Hey, John, on the most recent podcast you read from a listener that he said he is frustrated with the podcast as of late with all the article reading. Personally, I love the articles. I love hearing about the contest reports or stories from the golden era, like the recent Sergio stories, not to mention the huge catalog of older episodes. I really appreciate the work you do, and I always look forward to new episodes, regardless of how long they take to release. There aren't a lot of people doing long-form content on the golden era, plus doing content on the modern stuff with the Muscle Maturity podcast. It's all great content, and I appreciate the work you do. Vincent Van Gool." All right. Thank you, Vincent. This one says, "Hey, John, before anything, thank you for sharing your knowledge, experience, and time. I love the podcast, and I use it to keep me motivated. The history of our sport and art is so fascinating. I started lifting at 12 years old after seeing Pumping Iron in 1982, and I've been doing so on and off for the years. I spent 20 years in the Army, and during those years, my training was sidetracked, but now I'm retired. I'm back on track at 54. On to the reason for my email. I'm not sure you're aware of the individual named John Hart. John is a natural bodybuilder and a protege of Mike Mentzer. He was a friend of Mike's and a trainee, a believer in HIT. I think he would make an interesting guest. Here's the link to his YouTube channel. I must also add, I love when you read the old articles. In a day and age of no muscle brags, it's a great way to go back in time. Thank you for your time and for all you do. Chris K." All right. Thank you, Chris. Yeah, I am aware of John for sure. And I should reach out to him. That's a great idea for a guest. Especially we could talk about Mentzer and we could talk about, I didn't know he was a protege, Mike Mentzer. So yeah, I would definitely reach out to him. And I got one more. It says, "Hey, John, I just thought I'd take a minute to let you know so many of us still love the podcast. Last week you had a letter from someone named Brad and I wanted to make sure you didn't think that could be me. When you're unable to get a guest, I've enjoyed the articles. It's funny, sometimes I remember them from my teenage years, reading them firsthand. I've been here from the start, and I appreciate what you do to preserve the sport's history. Keep it up. A longtime listener, Brad Allen. All right, Brad. Thank you. No, I didn't think it was you, Brad, so you're good. Brad has always been a good supporter of the show, like he says. So I appreciate the support you got. I've got more emails this week than normal, so thank you for your support, and great to hear from all you guys, and I'm glad you enjoy it. And I will continue doing the show as long as we can. And like I said, when we don't get guests, we'll just try to do the articles. All right. Well, with that being said, let's get on with our interview with Jerry Branum. And this is part two of our interview, where we're going to talk about the Mr. Olympia from 1976 all the way up till 1983. Here we go. All right. The next era I thought we could talk about, I'll call them the Columbus years. So these were the years after Arnold retired in 1975. He teamed up with Jim Lorimer, and they started promoting the Mr. Olympia in Columbus, Ohio, where Jim is from. Mm-hmm. And they really raised the contest promotion level, because they really brought in great lighting, great production values. It was really at a whole new level, where before it was very amateurish.
Right.
And they also opened up for the first time. This is hard to believe, looking back at it now, but they never had the prejudging open to the public.
Right.
It was always closed. And even like if you look at Pumping Iron, in the beginning of Pumping Iron, when Arnold's up there and Franco and stuff, you could see the audience. There's nobody in the audience. It's just the photographers and the officials.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great idea. Let's open this up to the public and charge everybody. You know, it was probably $5 for a ticket back then. But, I mean, how much more money did they make, you know, having 4,000 people at the Veterans Memorial Auditorium, you right. know, charging twice for prejudging and night show, you know?
It was a good idea. Yeah.
So now when this happened, I don't know if it's because now Arnold was no longer in it, and they already thought they had a chance, but now the competitors really went up. So in 1976, you had Franco win it. Now, there's only two guys in the over 200-pound class. It was Ken Waller and Mike Katz, so that was a pretty weak class. Serge Dubray wasn't in it. Lou Ferrigno wasn't in it. But Franco and Dane had a really good battle in the under 200-pound class. And then you had Boyer Coe going in it for the first time. Ed Corney came back. You had Bill Grant come back. So it was a really, really good contest.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 76. And then in 77, Zane won. And then he won three in a row from 77, 78, 79. And what's significant about those years, Jerry, is that now it was being covered on television.
Right.
And BBC Wide World of Sports covered it in 1977. So now it was getting, you know, coverage. And then I think this is what really kind of started the interest in bodybuilding. And then, you know, by the time we got into the 1980s, that was really bodybuilding's peak.
Yeah.
I think as far as public acceptance, people were discovering bodybuilding, and it was really taken off.
Well, two things stand out about the Zane years, if you want to call it that, those 3 years.
Yeah.
First of all, one of his biggest threats was Robbie Robinson.
Yes.
And the thing about Robbie is Robbie had this problem where he would look fantastic, almost like Serge, almost unbeatable a couple of weeks before the show. But on the night of the show, it's not that he looked bad, but he always looked like he had a little water retention, whereas Zane was super sharp. As you know, I think you mentioned attending some of these contests as a young
guy. I was at all three, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, Zane was like in peak, correct me if I'm wrong, he was in absolute peak condition.
Right.
Even though Robbie was thicker than him and had much better arms and this and that, Zane looked just much more conditioned, so he won. That's the first thing that I always think about with those years. The second thing is the famous interview where Arnold, I think it was Wide World of Sports, I think, was covering, I don't remember. They were actually covering the Olympia for TV, as you pointed out, and Arnold was the commentator, you know. And Zane had just won the show, and he, you know, Arnold has the microphone, he's wearing a suit, and he says to Zane, you know, Zane's standing there in the posing truck, he says, "Frank, how does it feel to win the Mr. Olympia?" And Frank Zane says, "It feels almost as good as when I beat you back in what was it?
I 68 forgot what. At the Mr. Universe."
And you know, and I still to this day, I if you could find that video, look at Arnold's face when he said Arnold very briefly loses his composure,
yeah,
but catches himself.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Arnold did not expect Zane to say that. It was hilarious. No,
he was very mad. He was very
mad. Oh, yeah. And afterwards, I heard Arnold was furious.
Yeah.
I heard that he called Zane and said, oh, he was pissed off, really mad.
Yeah.
Zane. You know, but I actually liked Zane saying that. You know, it's because remember, Arnold was always, you know, playing psych games with the other guys and, you know, talking about how they could never beat this and that. And it's Arnold, basically, it was Arnold getting his own medicine.
That's what Zane told him. He goes, "Oh, yeah, well, the joke's on you. It's not so funny, is it?"
Yeah. I mean, Arnold, you know, was he a guy who could give it but can't take it?
Exactly, right.
No, if you're gonna, you know, try and psych out the other guys and make fun of them, you're going to be able to take yourself or shut up, you know? So I'm glad that Zane, I always gave him credit for doing that.
Yeah, those are some great contests. I mean, I was never obviously at the Brooklyn Academy of Music like you were because I was too young. But I think the Columbus shows had a similar level of intensity and the audience reaction. I mean, it was the atmosphere was so electric. It was really amazing. It was really awesome.
Well, bodybuilding was already heading for its peak years. It was getting more popular. That right there, it started really in the late 70s, and it started to get more and more popular.
That's when it really,
I mean, the magazines were around the whole time, but for some reason, maybe it's Arnold, maybe it's Pumping Iron, I don't know, but it started to catch on much more.
I think it was Pumping Iron. I think that had a big influence on it.
Yeah, I think so too.
I mean, I think most of the people there, I think, were hardcore fans. You know, I don't think they were new people that didn't know anything about bodybuilding, but I think Pumping Iron really brought way more attention and got a lot more people interested in bodybuilding.
I mean, think about it, John. I mean, if it wasn't for, let's say, Pumping Iron, would the big network like ABC, would they consider, you know?
Probably not. Yeah, probably not.
What would have happened? I think it was the success of Pumping Iron that opened the door, let's say, to greater publicity outside of the bodybuilding. But as you point out, the truth is that most of the audience, and I think this still holds true today, is almost, I would say, at least 98% hardcore bodybuilding fans.
Yeah.
They want to see the hardcore, you know, like you see some of the guys today, some of the big guys like this guy, what's his name again? What's his name? Nick Walker, Big Ramy, these kind of guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the average person, even a lot of bodybuilders will say, oh, these guys are too big. I mean, but, you know, the fans, the hardcore bodybuilders, the way their perception is, the freakier and bigger these guys look, the more I love it. You know what I mean? Yeah. They want to see that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the famous words of Wayne D'Amelio after the 1990 drug test in Olympia. When I said, Wayne, are you going to continue to drug? Absolutely not. He says the quality was down. And these are the words that I'm referring. He says, people want to see freaks.
Yeah.
And it's true. The hardcore fans want to see as much muscle as possible.
Well, if you go back to 77, the year Pumping Iron came out, that's also the year Arnold came out with his book, Education of a Bodybuilder. And he was promoting that thing all over the country. So I think the combination of those two things really brought up the interest in bodybuilding. And that's probably, you're right, that's probably why ABC, why World of Sports wanted to get involved. And not only were they involved, but then CBS Sports Spectacular, which was basically the same thing as ABC, why World of Sports, they had their own sports show. They outbid why World of Sports, and they signed a three-year deal with them. And I think it was 30,000 or 50,000 a year they were paying Arnold and Lorimer to film the show.
Yeah.
And it was 79, 80, and 81.
Yeah.
And then, of course, 80 and 81, which we'll talk about in a second when we get to those shows, they never even did it. So they signed a three-year deal. And they had to pay every year, even though they didn't.
But, you know, there's two men that you have to give credit for really kind of spreading or increasing the popularity of bodybuilding. The first would have to be Joe Weider. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Joe, through his magazines and his publicity of the bodybuilders and his focus on bodybuilding rather than, let's say, Olympic weightlifting like the York magazines did,
you know,
Bob Huff and Strength Enough, he kind of helped popularize bodybuilding. But Arnold himself, when he came on the scene, again, with the Pumping Iron movie, his book, and the segue into the movies, where not only bodybuilders, but everybody saw this, you know, great physique of Arnold, Conan, all those movies.
Yeah.
I mean, that caused bodybuilding to soar through the stratosphere for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, that really, Arnold's influence to me was comparable to kind of what Steve Reeves did many, many years before. playing Hercules because, I mean, God knows how many people he inspired, including myself.
Yeah.
To get into body. When I saw Hercules as a kid, I was dumbfounded by this guy's. I had never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole persona of Steve, this handsome guy and tiny waist and, you know, just fantastic. I couldn't wait to start working out. You know what I mean?
But I think what made Arnold different than Reeves was that he would go on these talk shows and he would explain what bodybuilding is, and he would make it more, you know, palatable, I guess, for the general public, where people could, oh, I understand it more now. You know, I get it. Where before it was thought of as this really weirdo sport. Nobody would even look at it. And Arnold made it like kind of cool and kind of like, you know, hip and all that. And then it became like cool to work out. And then everybody started getting into that.
Like, absolutely. Arnold's personality. And as I said to you a long time ago, we did an interview a long time ago, Arnold stood out among the bodybuilders of that era because he was the only one that really had the personality. Like the Tonight Show, and, you know, had this self-deprecating humor where he could make fun of himself. Frank, all these guys were great guys. Frank, Zane, Dave, they didn't have Arnold's.
They wouldn't have been able to do it.
What's it called?
Charisma.
Charisma. And let's say, open personality to do that kind of, they just didn't do it. So it was necessary for a guy like Arnold to be around to increase the popularity of bodybuilding. I do believe.
I remember being in high school and I was into bodybuilding and I would watch Arnold on the Tonight Show. And this was before he was Conan, you know, way before, a couple of years before. So he wasn't a movie star yet, but he would just go on there as a bodybuilder, usually when he was doing one of his books or something. Right. And even as a kid, as a teenager, I was so impressed that Arnold had so much confidence being on the Johnny Carson show, which was a big deal.
Yeah, you know,
I mean, I think most people going on the Johnny Carson show would have been a nervous wreck because it's watched live, right? Or it was, I don't know if they taped it, but it was watched by millions of people. It was the biggest show at night, for sure. It was the biggest talk show in the world. It was a big, big deal. And he would go on there like, no big deal. Like, he would just cross his legs and he'd be joking with Johnny and he'd joke with the other people on the show. And I remember sometimes other shows he would do, the host would be kind of nasty toward him and they would like try to make jokes and he just laughed it off and he knew how to handle these people. He'd get right back at them. He was so quick, you know, and he was so confident. And so I don't think people today who don't know who Arnold is, they don't realize the impact that he had on promoting bodybuilding. Because like you said, Jerry, no one else could have did that. Lou Ferrigno could have did it. Frank Zane could have. Franco couldn't have did it. Nobody.
I remember when Chris Dickerson went on the Tonight Show. Remember that?
Yeah, when he used to work there, right?
Yeah, Chris was a page at NBC. And Johnny Carson, I remember one night he's looking at the camera, he says, I just found out we have a page working for us who's Mr. America. He says, let's bring him out. And, you know, Chris comes out and he poses. And Chris always looked great. And Chris was very well-spoken.
Yeah.
Had a great voice, was a very intelligent guy. But you could see Chris, unfortunately, was kind of intimidated being on TV. You know, if you know Chris, you know that you could see he was not him, you know, he wasn't as open as Arnold would say could be.
Yeah.
So that's underscoring what you're saying. You needed a guy as extroverted as Arnold to, like, you know, like you say, they can insult him, it would roll right off him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, you know, some of the other guys would.
I remember being like I said, I was a kid, but as a bodybuilder, I was like, yeah, you show him Arnold. You know, he was like standing up for all of us. You know, he was promoting bodybuilding. But if they tried to get at him and say, bodybuilders are stupid, or he'd be like right at him. You know, I'm like, man, that guy was like, he could handle himself better than anybody.
And not only that, Arnold got people involved in weight training who weren't necessarily interested in being bodybuilders.
Right.
Arnold would often talk about the health benefits.
Yeah.
You know, and remember back then, the health benefits still weren't really scientifically widely circulated. Arnold would talk about it anyway. You know, you lower your body fat, it's good for your heart, this, that. And later on, all this was confirmed.
Yeah.
But, you know, somebody watching that, because Arnold basically looked like a big, healthy guy. And they say, you know, maybe I should look into this weight training. You know, maybe it would be good. He probably got a lot of people lifting weights only because of the fact they would help them. Maybe these are people that weren't interested in being bodybuilders.
Right.
Only to help improve their appearance. Arnold even got women involved. He wrote a book for women.
Yeah.
Lisa Lyon was in, I remember.
Yeah,
it was
1979, you
know, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he even got women involved in weight training. I mean, so Arnold was a fantastic spokesman. I'm probably the number one ever in body by. I have to
He was, for sure. No doubt.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the next era in the Mr. Olympia, and I would call these the controversial years. So this was 80 and 81, and I think these two contests being back-to-back really stood out because you had Arnold come back after a five-year layoff, and then Franco came back after a five-year layoff, and they both won, and they were both really, really controversial. To this day, still the most controversial Mr. Olympias ever. Yeah. How much do you think those shows hurt bodybuilding, because it was starting to gain some really mainstream popularity? And, you know, we mentioned CBS Sports Spectacular, and they actually went down to Australia in 1980 and filmed the show, and then they actually didn't even put it on. They went through all this expense, bringing a camera crew to Australia, filming it, and then they just shelved it. They didn't even put it on. And then in 1981, they didn't even go.
Right.
They said, we'll pay you the money. We owe you the money. We signed a contract, but we're not going. We're not even going to film it.
Well, I think my opinion is that the 80 and 81 Olympias to this day, the previous most controversial Mr. Olympia was that 72 one in Essen.
Yeah. When,
you know, these two, to me, to my mind, these still, after all these years, still are by far the most controversial judging decisions. Now, as I said, when I, right after the 80 Olympia, I ran into a couple of people who competed. I don't remember, was Frank saying, a couple other people who told me that that was the Essen one, but the 81, I remember looking at the photos, and there was already stuff going around that Arnold shouldn't have won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my first impression when looking at the pictures was definitely Arnold was not the same as he was in the, let's say, 73, 74. He was definitely off. However, in some poses, he still was extremely dominant over the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when he did, let's say, the side arm pose like that, his arm dwarfed everybody. Even Boyer Coe, who had fantastic, the only guy who came close was Boyer.
Yeah.
That shot. I mean, but like his legs, they talk about his legs. His legs were really down compared to the way he was. I mean, as you pointed out, in 73, his legs actually were better than usual. They weren't just passable like Larry Scott's were. They were spectacular development he had.
Yeah.
Whereas in Sydney, they were barely passable. I mean, you know,
right.
I mean, you know, and the thing is, though, that, you know, you could say that he shouldn't have won because of that, but in some poses, I've looked at a lot of photos from the show, and his upper body, again, was not like it was in Sydney, but it was still good enough where it still might have been up in the air. In other words, where a lot of people who, and I think you've interviewed some of these people, where they say that, yeah, Arnold wasn't at his best, but he was still good enough to win. That's the frequency. Well,
that's why I think, you know, what are we on, 40 to 43 years, 44 years later, I think it's still debated.
It's still debated.
Just because of what you said, Jerry. It's like sometimes some people think, yeah, he wasn't at his best, but he was still good enough to win. Other people feel like, no, he shouldn't have won. And it's just these two people going back, you know, these two sides going back and forth. And that's why it's still so debated. Where I think 81, I think everybody agrees. I have never heard anyone say Franco should have won. You know?
No. That was definitely off. But now in the 80, let's put it this way. If I were a judge, would I have had Arnold first? And the answer to that is no. Because I knew how Arnold looked in the past. And as I say, the way the Mr. Olympia is judged, the current Mr. Olympia, Arnold, even though he wasn't the current Mr. Olympia, he had the track record of several Mr. Olympia titles. He would be like the standard to judge the other guys on.
Yeah.
And since Arnold was off and not at his best, I would have to look at the other guys and say, well, how does Chris Dickerson, Frank Zane, the other guys, are they at their best?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is the other guys, especially Chris. Chris was at his peak condition. He wasn't not nearly as big as Arnold, but he had a far more complete body.
Right.
And I remember when they turned to the back pose, Chris was a lot smaller than Arnold, but his back, strangely looked almost as wide as Arnold. I mean, he looked great. I mean,
but it was thick. It was cut. Yeah. I mean, like you said, it was a trained physique.
Trained physique, and Frank and some of these other guys, including Mike Mentzer, I mean, they were in peak condition. Arnold was not.
Right.
I mean, you can't you know, you could say, well, Arnold won because he's Arnold. A lot of people have said that. He won because of the aura and the, you know, this thing about Arnold, you know, he won because he's Arnold. That's not fair. You can't, you know, you have to judge a guy as he looked that night. I would have had Arnold probably somewhere around sixth place.
Yeah.
That's crazy to say that. But, you know, if I was there in person, maybe I'd have a different opinion. But I'm judging by the many, many photos and a couple of videos I've seen. I would have had Chris Dickinson ahead of him. I'm not sure I'd have Mike Mentzer, but probably and Frank Zane ahead of him.
You know, Boyerko.
Yeah, Boyerko, definitely. You know, these guys I would have had because they were, that night, were in more peak condition than Arnold. And that's what I was going to call.
Yeah.
You know, as far as the 81, that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I
agree with you about 1980 because if it was where Arnold was good enough, you know, but he wasn't at his best, but he was good enough, then there wouldn't be all this controversy. There wouldn't be all those competitors complaining. There wouldn't be all the people in the audience complaining. You know, I heard there was a lot of booing. There wouldn't have been all that if Arnold was good enough, you know.
Just imagine, John, what if Arnold showed up looking exactly like he did in 74? Would anyone ever say anything?
Oh, no. I think everybody agrees with that.
Yeah. Arnold would have destroyed them. It would be like when Coleman used to walk out on his peak years, when everybody would go in and say, okay, it's over. Let's see who's going to get second on deck.
But like you said, Jerry, in a couple shots, you know, even like standing relaxed because he was so much taller and wider, he does look like he could have won.
Yeah, that's right.
But when you start looking at the total body and you start seeing these guys like Dickerson and Zane and Mentzer and Boyerko that were completely developed, you know, they might not have had the genetics Arnold had, but they were completely developed. I can see why there's so much controversy because a lot of those guys probably should have beaten Arnold because they had complete physiques, you know.
That's my point, yeah. Now, as far as 81 goes, that's a whole different ballgame. 81 was the most ridiculous, if you said, what is the single most ridiculous Mr. Olympia contest?
Yeah.
Unhesitatingly, I'd say 1981.
I think 81 was everybody was on eggshells going into that contest because of what happened in 1980. Because I was at that show, and I remember, like, I was debating on whether to buy tickets for the contest because I heard nobody was going to show up.
Didn't people like Chris, a couple of competitors like Chris, a couple of, they didn't even want to compete that year, am I right?
Chris did, but Zane didn't, Boyerko and Mentzer didn't.
Okay, because they saw the handwriting on the wall.
In fact, they tried to get everybody to sign a letter and boycott it.
Wow.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of people did sign the letter, but then a lot of people went back on their word and went.
Yeah, that's what happens in bodybuilding.
Yeah.
I mean, Franco had a fantastic upper body. I mean, the pectorals, the back, he didn't have a. I mean, you were there. I mean, to me, he looked like he had no definition in his legs at all.
Yeah, none, no.
None. I mean, I know he had that refrigerator.
And I think after the prejudging, everybody was feeling like, okay, they're not going to do this again, are they? They're not going to have another controversial. After what happened last year in Australia, they're not going to do this again.
Right.
So I think, like I said, everybody was really, there was a lot of tension on what was going to happen because it was clear what was on stage was, you know, you had Platts, you had Padilla, you had calendar, those three guys alone. And then you also had Dickerson, who was maybe not at his best. He wasn't as good as 1980, but he was still better than Franco.
Right.
But they all had great legs. All four of those guys had great legs.
Danny Padilla was fantastic that year.
Even Callender had great legs, you know.
Rugg was in great shape. I mean, all these guys. And, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember reading somewhere that even Joe Weider was pissed off about that.
He walked out.
I can imagine Joe Weider walking out of
that. Weider and Arnold did not go on stage and hand Franco his trophy.
Wow. I mean,
you notice all the pictures with Arnold and Franco with the trophy, they're backstage.
Wow. That really tells you something right there.
Yeah.
But the question is, was it, you know, this is the lingering question about that show. Was it fixed for Franco? I mean,
got the judges' score sheets so everybody could see them, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what was the rationale, I'd like to know, of the judges to, pick Franco over those other guys like Padilla and the guys you mentioned?
Yeah, I think what it was they had that point system, and 20 points was the highest you could award somebody in a round, 20 points. And you could give out multiple 20 points. You could give out multiple 19s. It wasn't like the placement system where you had, like, first, second, third, fourth. You know, so you could give a guy, you know, if you saw, like, I'll give Padilla a 20, I'll give Franco a 20. And I think because of who Franco was, because he was a former Mr. Olympia, him and Arnold were like legends, you know. So we're not going to put these guys fifth, you know. There's no way.
Yeah.
But let's give him a 20. You know, he's in good shape. But I'll also give Tom Platz a 20. You know, and I think enough judges did that where maybe not everybody had Franco in first, but at the end of the day, after they got done adding up all the scores, Franco was in first.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting when you think about it, both Arnold and Franco, Arnold didn't deserve to win in 80 because he wasn't in top shape and his legs were considerably off.
Yeah.
And the next year, Franco had, again, great upper body, just as good as he did when he won the Olympia before, but legs were terrible.
Yeah,
they both had no leg development.
No legs, yeah.
I mean, Mr. Olympia, I'm sorry, has to have a complete
right. Especially by the 1980s, because it was different than the 1970s, right?
Yeah.
You had more guys with better legs.
I mean, today it's gotten even worse.
Oh, yeah,
today,
yeah.
When you have the Olympia, not only do you have to have fully developed front thighs, but, I mean, like back then, the guys, even Arnold, their leg biceps were never really that spectacular.
No.
But today, when the guys turn to the rear, they got to have these on the side. They got to have these massive hamstrings.
Yeah.
They have, you know, cuts going down their leg, the back of the leg. Even they
by the 1980s, it was a whole different scene.
Yeah, I mean, they have to have defined. I saw a picture of this guy. What's his name? One of the guys who might be a guy named Theo Longoria, something like that. He's from. He got last year. He got 13th place. He's from France. He's one of the guys that qualified for the Olympia. I saw a picture of him online where he did a naked photo of himself from the back. I must have been on his Instagram page. And, you know, he had his butt there, but it was just shredded.
Oh, yeah. You got to shred it boots now.
I mean, this is it reminds me of the time I was on a plane to Columbus for the Arnold show. Do you remember when Flex used to have those pull-out photos? You know. And I had the new Flex in my hand. I was sitting next to Bill Dobbins. He was a photographer and writer. And I pulled out, there was Debbie something or other. You remember that girl from the
Debbie back? Muggly.
Debbie Muggly. There was a pullout of her. And, you know, they had this brief period where for some reason in Flex, they were using nude photos of female bodybuilders from the back, right? Now, the photo of Debbie Muggly, she was lying on her side from the back, naked, but her glutes were absolutely shredded. So, and I turned to Bill Dobbins, who had taken the photo. I said, Bill, I said, this is the first time I've ever seen a photo of a naked woman where I didn't get turned on. And Dobbins' response was, you're not supposed to be turned on.
It's just muscle.
Just muscle, exactly. You know, so that's the kind of feeling I got when I saw this guy, this French guy's photo.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I don't know, you know, amazing.
So do you think those years of 80 and 81 hurt bodybuilding as far as the general public goes?
I don't think it
set the sport back, no?
I don't think so. I think, created kind of a stench among bodybuilding fans for a while and still does to this day.
What do you think if Arnold and Franco didn't go in it and CBS would have filmed both shows and, you know, what kind of impact do you think that would have had as far as the Mr. Olympia goes, as far as the general public? I mean, because if 77, 78, 79 Olympias were all on TV and they were promoting bodybuilding and it was, you know, a positive image. I remember it, like even being in Columbus, it was even in like it was on the news, like the local news. You know, and it was in the newspaper the next day and stuff like that. So it's starting to get like mass media attention, you know, where it's in newspapers and magazines and not magazines, but newspapers and television. So what if somebody else would have, like, what if somebody else would have won 80 or 81 and Arnold and Franco wouldn't have went in it and he wouldn't have had all that controversy? I wonder if it would have kept advancing the sport, you know?
I think it would have definitely helped the publicity of the sport.
Yeah.
If those contests had been, let's say, judged more fairly, I think.
Let's just say they weren't in it, you know.
Yeah, they weren't in
it. It was just a regular Mr. Olympia. But
I think that there would have probably been no controversy at all. You know, I don't know who would have won.
I know there would. Yeah, I just wonder, like, if it would have made the sport more popular.
Probably. I probably
better on TV and stuff, you know.
I think it would have gotten more TV coverage for at least a couple of more years. And that
Yeah, I agree.
That greatly promoted bodybuilding.
I agree, yeah.
But also, the TV definitely hurt. So, yeah, those guys not being in it would have helped
them. Yeah, because that was before the internet and streaming.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, the TV was a big deal. And
yeah, for the general public, that was
it
everything.
It stopped
yeah.
after that.
Yeah, that's everything, yeah. So, yeah, I agree. It would have helped bodybuilding if those guys hadn't competed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess the next era, Jerry, would I guess we call it the in-between years, between the controversial years and between the Lee Haney years. And that would have been 82 and 83. So you had Dickerson win in 82, and then you had Samir win in 83. So you had two winners, and they were smaller guys. They weren't big guys like Sergio or Arnold. And, you know, it was, I guess, fairly judged, I think. I mean, some people thought Dickerson shouldn't have won. Some people thought other people should have won. But I guess Dickerson, they felt like he deserved it after taking two controversial seconds in a row. But it was basically a back on track, I guess, you know.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of people over the years, and I still see this, they called Chris Dickerson the worst Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
They said he didn't deserve the title. You know, all right, Chris had weak biceps, you know, but I mean, if you look at his overall physique, I think when he was in shape, he was an incredible bodybuilder.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
He wasn't the biggest guy, but, you know, first of all, he had great stage presence. He was a good poser, always looked confident. And not only that, but he had a head to toe body where when he stood relaxed, he looked like he had literally no weak points. Only weak point showed up when he would flex his arm. And you see the weak bicep development. He had a great back. He had good shoulders. I mean, I think Chris Dickerson is very underrated. And yeah, he wasn't tall. He was like Arnold. He wasn't a big guy, but he had a complete physique.
Yeah.
And again, I hate to be redundant, but to me, I keep saying Mr. Olympia needs to have a complete physique.
Yeah.
And nobody's perfect. Chris had weak biceps, true, but he had pretty good weak biceps. But he had pretty good triceps.
Yeah, you had good side triceps.
You see his side tricep pose wasn't bad.
Yeah.
I think he definitely deserved to win the Mr. Olympia. I think people are wrong. Because, you know, they put him down because he wasn't the biggest guy. But
yeah. I think the people saying that, too, they don't know his career. They haven't seen pictures of when he won the NAVA Universe or when he won the America. They don't realize the extent of his career and all those shows he won.
Plus, not only that, but unlike them, they never saw him in person in shape.
That's true.
I mean, you know, photos and videos give you a certain impression.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit different when you actually see the person right in front of you.
That's true.
You see the way the guy looks. And let me tell you, when this guy was in shape, Dickerson, he was fantastic. He looked almost unbeatable. I mean, he looked great.
Yeah.
Everything looked great on the guy. He was in fantastic shape.
When I think about those contests, so now after I should also mention after 1979, back starting in 1980, they started doing just one class. They didn't have an under 200, over 200. But when I think of 83 or 82 and 83, I just think about the wide variety of physiques that were up there. You had smaller guys, you had bigger guys, you had symmetrical guys, you had more massive guys. And then it was just like they're all thrown together. And this was before I think the mass monsters really took off and before the judges started going just for mass. So you had a guy like McAway who could place really good. You had a guy like Samir who could win.
Yeah.
Then you had Frank Zane was still competing in both of those shows. This was the end of his career after he won the Olympia three times.
Yeah.
So it was just amazing. I think those shows are very interesting to look at because you had such a variety of physiques and they were all put together and then the judges had to decide. And then they were also had three rounds of judging.
Right.
And the first round was symmetry. The second round was compulsory posing. The third round was posing. And they were all judged. The posing was judged, too. That's why you could have a guy like McAway place high because his posing was so fantastic. So this way, I think it was those were great examples of what bodybuilding could be if you judge the complete physique, if you judge symmetry, if you judge size, if you judge posing, and you judge everything. That's an example of what it could have been. But then they let it, I think, kind of go off the rails.
Well, those years were examples of when the physique, the number one quality that was looked for was quality.
Yeah.
In other words, conditioning, you know, the emphasis wasn't on the biggest arm. I mean, to give you a perfect example, when Samir, again, correct me if I'm wrong, you know about this better than I do, John, but wasn't Bertil Fox in that contest?
He was in both of them, yeah, both of them.
And Bertil Fox was one of the early mass monsters.
He was, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nobody could say Bertil Fox was small.
Right.
This is another guy, by the way, that you had to see in person to really appreciate.
Yeah, I bet.
And he was huge, this guy. I mean, he was thick. Like, he had a physique. I remember looking at this guy and saying, you could shoot this guy with a bullet. It looked like it would
never hit through.
He was so damn thick.
If you hit him with a car, he'd dent the car.
I saw him getting ready for a photo session at Gold's Gym when he was on 2nd Street. And, you know, they used to use these fake balsa wood dumbbells that weighed about maybe a half a pound. They looked like they weighed 100 pounds each, right?
Yeah.
They used to do the photo sessions. And I saw him, he's standing in front of the dumbbell rack, and he was doing these curls. And I said, oh, look at that. He's doing the balsa wood dumbbells. And I looked closer, John, they were 85-pound dumbbells.
Wow.
And he was curling it like this, like they were 40s.
Nothing, yeah.
And I said, holy Toledo, look at the strength on this guy.
Yeah.
Gee, you know what I mean? But, I mean.
Yeah, he took 7th and 5th in those shows. So that goes to show you they weren't like mass about everything else.
That's my point. That's my point. In other words, later on, Berto probably would have done a lot better than
He was ahead of his time.
Even though you had guys like McAway and Samir being in such superlative shape, they would be considered too small. And Frank Zane.
Yeah.
You know, the emphasis completely shifted. I don't know what year that would be. We have to figure that out. It slowly shifted to size being the paramount importance.
Yes.
Meaning that, you know, if you have a big guy who's in good shape compared to a smaller guy who's in better shape, they're going to still give it to the bigger guy. And that's the way it is to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, you have shorter guys winning, like Heidi and Derek, but they're still kind of big guys.
Oh, they're very big guys.
These are big guys.
Yeah, they're not small at all. No.
I mean, as great as he was, there's no question Frank Zane was one of the greatest bodybuilders. I'll always credit that. Frank wouldn't do shit today. I'm sorry, you know.
Well, like you said, Samir in 83 was one of the best physiques ever, and he wouldn't do shit today.
He wouldn't do shit. Maybe there's an outside chance that Frank and Samir in the classic bodybuilding, they might make the top three.
But now they categorize it, where back then it was
you're right. No, but today you're right. And Samir in 83 – was the one of the most peak bodybuilders ever.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at photos of him, and I saw him at the time. In fact, I was kind of helping him a little bit prepare for that show. But I remember his cheeks literally was so – I mean, if you saw him in person a couple of days before the show, his cheek was so sunken in, it looked like there was nothing left there.
Yeah.
I mean, and I remember touching his abs, John. I touched his abs. And they felt like steel.
Yeah.
Didn't feel like human flesh.
Yeah.
There was literally no fat there at all.
Right.
Samir likes to tell people he was 1% fat. You know, I mean, I doubt it. I don't think that's true. But I'll tell you what, the man was as low body fat as you could possibly get.
Yeah.
He had no fat, and his back was, oh my God, was his back great. Fantastic. Yeah. And Samir had good calves. He had that complete body look.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like I say, he had, just like Chris, he had an overall quality physique. There's no question about it.
Yeah. All right. So that was part two of our interview with Jerry. And before I let you guys go, I want to read some articles from some magazines. And the first one I'm going to read, as I mentioned in the beginning, is from May 1980. It's from Muscle and Fitness magazine. Actually, it's weird. On the cover, it just says Joe Weider's Muscle. I wonder if this was before he was calling it Muscle and Fitness. Or maybe they made a mistake on the cover. Anyways, the article is called In Defense of Zane. And this is from the 1979 Mr. Olympia. It was written by Gary Bartlett. And Gary was obviously a big fan of Frank Zane. And he believes Frank should have won the 1979 Mr. Olympia over Mike Mentzer. Because some people criticized the contest decision. They thought Mike should have beat Frank. So it says, at the Olympia, the judges are never wrong. Instead, it's often the spectators who make bad decisions, by Gary Bartlett. He says, I'm fed up with listening to and reading things by Mike Mentzer's Mr. Olympia supporters. Everything I've heard or read has been opposed to Zane winning the Olympia, but Zane clearly deserved to win. I attended the Mr. Olympia show as a photographer and thus had a ringside seat for both the prejudging and the evening show. Therefore, my opinions are not without foundation. Here are the facts. Number one, Zane was bigger than he's ever been. Two, Zane was more ripped than ever before. Three, Zane was as flawless as ever in his symmetry and proportions. Four, Zane was more masterful than ever in his stage presentation. How can anyone criticize the close-to-perfect physique of Frank Zane? Admittedly, Mensur was fantastic, bigger and more muscularly dense than ever before, but Zane deserved to win. In fact, both these great leader champions probably deserved to win. Only one man could win, however, and I think that the final decision came down to what type of physique the judges personally preferred. If you study the comparison photos with this article, you'll notice the contrasting development of these two men. Zane looks like a prized thoroughbred racehorse, while Mensur looks more like a massively developed workhorse. Which would the judges prefer? At the prejudging, it was very close, and both Zane and Mensur made emphatic physical statements that they were the best. Both were magnificent. I feel Mensur lost the race in the final yards. Perhaps Mike would even admit that he blew it at the evening show. Anyone who really watched closely at Columbus could see that Mensur made the following errors at the evening show. Number one, he went mano a mano with the pose down against Zane, who is a master of the art. Instead of trying to match Frank pose for pose, Mike should have slowed his presentation and concentrated only on his most powerful and explosive poses in his routine. Two, Mike projected tremendous confidence at the afternoon prejudging, but seemed to have lost his aggressiveness at the evening show. Three, Mike often forgot to flex his thighs, particularly the left one. Four, perhaps Mike could have been more ripped. When the two classes were judged separately, I thought Mensur was ripped. But when he and Zane were finally compared that night, Frank was clearly more muscular. Five, finally, Mike committed the cardinal error of relaxing his stomach, which sagged in an unesthetic and symmetry-destroying curve away from his body. It seems that every time Zane wins the Olympia, he is attacked as an undeserving winner and doesn't get the credit he deserves. This is unfair. Nearing 40, Frank continues to improve every year, and despite all criticism, he continues to win. Frank Zane has to have something going for him to win the Mr. Olympia title three times in a row. Indeed, the man is what bodybuilding is all about. He's taken a basically average physical structure and molded it into a work of art. Many at the Olympia thought that Boyer Coe should have won. Coe was definitely in his best shape of his life, but he still has marked physical deficiencies. He has improved his abdominals considerably, for example, but there's still no match for Zane's famous washboard formation. Coe was certainly massive and he posed masterfully, but his physique lacks the aesthetic appeal of Zane's. In particular, Boyer's thighs lack the much sought outside sweep that Zane displays so confidently. And Coe repeated Mensur's mistake of trying to pose mano a mano with Zane. One fact is paramount. Just because a man is in the best shape of his life, that's not enough reason to bestow a Mr. Olympia crown on him. It takes something extra, a quality of almost mystic power to achieve Mr. Olympia status. Only a handful have the type of magic charisma necessary to separate themselves from the masses of mere mortals. When Joe Reeder originated the idea of the Olympia in 1965, he probably didn't foresee how his baby would grow to be the pinnacle of world bodybuilding. Oh, yes, I did, the Master Blaster replies. Today, everyone who competes in the Olympia is a genuine superstar, but only the winner can be proclaimed a modern bodybuilding god. Only time will tell if Mensur, Coe, Robinson, Tinarino, etc. will ever achieve this exalted status. Don't ever believe that someone can win the Olympia by accident. These arguments against Zane's win are ridiculous. A man wins because the judges decide he is the best. At the Olympia, the judges are never wrong. Instead, it's often the spectators who make bad decisions. We had Scott, Oliva, Schwarzenegger, and Colombo. Now we have Zane. And then there's a side article here. It says, Zane, Mr. Olympia 1977, 78, 79. Frank Zane is a peerless competitor. Perhaps what distinguishes him most in a Mr. Olympia lineup is his supreme confidence. He trusts what he has made of himself. Years of experience have made him a glittering professional. Elegant in combat, he wields muscle with a mastery calculated to pique the passion of any crowd. In his electrifying performance at Columbus, his charged poses crackled with intensity. His timing was perfect, the thrust accurate. The cheers of the crowd rose to a roar and peaked at the level of thunder. Zane once again had lent enchantment to bodybuilding's top competition. All right. Well, that was interesting that he mentioned Mike's stomach sticking out. I wonder if Arnold read this article and then used that when they competed against each other the next year at the meeting before the contest, the judges' meeting. It's also interesting, he says, the judges are never wrong, the audience is. Well, that kind of came back to bite him in the ass the next 2 years in 1980 and 81. All right, I want to read this article from Iron Man, and this was from the March 1982 issue, and they were talking about the 1981 Mr. Olympia, and it was How I Saw the Mr. Olympia and the Top Six Men, written by Stephen Robinson. Our duty is to believe that for which we have sufficient evidence and to suspend our judgment when we have not. John Lubbock, 1803 to 1865. Give your decisions, never your reasons. Your decisions may be right. Your reasons are sure to be wrong. Earl of Mansfield, 1705 to 1793. Even 200 years ago, people had trouble judging. Yet here we are today still with the same problem. I was not of the caliber to stand among them, so who am I to say where they should stand? I would like to keep this article brief and to the point, trying to deal with just the top six men and let Gary Bartlett go into details. When I took my seat in the pit at the prejudging, I never thought it would take so long to see the 17 greatest physiques in the world. When I define greatest physiques, the words good sportsmanship and a forgiving nature are always in the back of my mind. The prejudging for the Mr. International lasted at least 4 hours. I cannot believe how the audience came alive after that prejudging for the Mr. Olympia. Well, here are my judgments. At the prejudging, Franco looked out of this world. He stood next to Roy Callender in the lineup, who kept prompting a pose off. When Franco finally replied, they were both reprimanded by Oscar State. At the prejudge, Franco had clear advantages. He was positioned in the middle so the judges could always see him. This he used well. I must admit, Franco to me looked like the best from my perch less than 20 feet away. He had something the others lacked, one of the attributes you could never put your finger on. Although his legs were not up to par, they looked good. His upper body was fantastic. At the night show, I decided to take a new vantage point among the people who really support the sport. I went to the back of the house. From there, Franco took on a new light. The fine detail I noticed from 20 feet diminished. In my prejudge prediction, I had him in first place. At the night show, I moved him back to second. Backstage, when I was again saw him pose up close, he was moved back into first place. All in all, Franco had a fight, and he won. I know this Olympia will be criticized as much as last year's. Let's hope it does not hurt the sport too much. Chris Dickerson placed second. I followed Chris since his comeback 2 years ago. I was in the same pit when he placed sixth in the Olympia. I've seen Chris in almost all the Grand Prix shows, and I've seen him in the best shape of his life. With Chris, I make my judgment on his past physique. Today, he was nowhere near his top shape. In my prejudge prediction, I didn't even have Chris in the top six. Standing in the lineup, it looked to me like he lacked his own aura of confidence. His stance, usually proud and of a winner, was awkward looking. But don't count this man out yet. He'll be a big winner again this coming year. Tom Platz, the new uncrowned Mr. Olympia. When I first saw this man in the basement selling his shirts and routines, he was mobbed by fans. Even through a sweatsuit, I could see a winner. At the prejudge, I had Tom in second place. At the night show, I really thought he'd won it. Tom was not only the audience favorite, but also the press favorite. So what happened to the judges? Tom took his defeat with all the dignity of a champion. Tom, you're the press Olympia. Roy Callender was the only prediction I made right. He was in the best shape of his life, but he seemed to lack something, something I can't put my finger on. But I'm sure Roy will someday be able to take this top title. Danny Padilla, my third place prediction, shot down by a fifth place finish. I've never seen Danny look like this before. John Balick described his attitude on stage by saying he could eat sharks. I'll bet he could have too. Many giants were killed in Columbus on that stage. Danny posed to Exodus. I thought he would have done much better to his short people. Also, he needs to improve his pose off routine a bit. Danny was also a press favorite. Don't give up yet. Josip Wilkosz was out of his league, but he has a good, strong-looking physique, but it does not stand up to the Olympias yet. But give him time. He will prove me wrong. Well, there you have it. I tried to keep it brief. I would like to apologize ahead of time for my rough criticism of the bodybuilders, but I'm only human, and I make mistakes just like the judges do. In closing, I'd like to give my own awards. Most improved, Mike Katz. Also, the most understanding. When asked what he thought of the contest, he had this to say. When Arnold was winning, no one complained because he was so much better than everyone else. But now the men are very close. No matter who wins, someone will complain. Most muscle per square inch, Johnny Fuller. I had Johnny in the top six, but believe it or not, he wants to add about 20 more pounds of muscle. Most forgiving, Dennis Tenorino and Chris Dickerson for giving up the boycott. Thank you. And then it says, editor's note, last issue we presented a different viewpoint of the Mr. Olympia. If the readers were there, they may agree with one or the other of our authors, but nearly everyone has a different selection for the top man. We have another story here by another author who feels the decision could have gone several ways. We understand that Mr. Olympia is supposed to go to London next year, and after that, it is uncertain what will happen to this contest, which in the past has been the big event of the year. Wow, that's the only article I ever read where the guy thought Franco should have won. I never read another article where anyone thought Franco should have won. But Franco did look good. I got to admit, I was there at the show in 1981, and Franco looked amazing. He had great condition. He was really probably the most ripped guy in the show. And he's right. That guy, that Steven is right. He did stand out. He had the charisma. He was a former Mr. Olympia. Obviously, everybody knows who Franco is. He's a legend. He's a champ. So everybody was looking at him for sure. But you can't deny the legs. I mean, if you're going to judge, you've got to judge the whole physique. And you got to take the legend down, or you just got to separate the legend from who the guy is standing on stage. And the legs were just so weak, especially when compared to Padilla and Platts and Callender. I mean, automatically, I would have had him fifth. All right, now let's read this big article by Jack Neary in the February 1981 issue of Muscle and Fitness. So this was the first article that really talked about the controversy of the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest in Sydney, Australia. And I think this was the first one that came out of all the magazines. I think Jack's article came out before anyone else. So it's kind of stood the test of time, like I said, and people still refer to it today. So if you guys have never heard it, I'm going to share it with you right now. Says Olympia Report by Jack Neary, Arnold's victory creates controversy and bitterness. How many times had the rumor been dredged up? How long had it drifted aimlessly through the gossip wards of bodybuilding like some sun-baked tumbleweed rolling down a windswept road to nowhere? How often had gym walls echoed the anticipation of Arnold Schwarzenegger's return from retirement? And how often had Arnold himself said, no, no, 1,000 times no, he was out to pasture to stay? Oh, there was talk 2 years ago of a special winner-take-all $100,000 match with rival Lou Ferrigno at Las Vegas, but that's all it was, talk. Life in the fast lane made for a contented Arnold, too busy chatting it up with the likes of Andy Warhol and Jackie O to callous his meaty palms with the knurling of a barbell. 5 years of retirement, the seminars, the endless tours to promote his books, the TV and movie acting, the contest promotion, etc., had left the mighty Arnold less massive and muscular than we'd known him. The once sharp, angular lines of his face softened. The great bulk, once carried in such a princely manner, shrank. His deltoids lost some of their coconut shape. The grapefruit-sized biceps atrophied to two-thirds their former dimension. The once powerful thighs could barely add substance to the legs of his trousers. The king had abdicated. The weeks before the 16th IFBB Mr. Olympia contest last October in Sydney, Australia, the rumor of the Austrian Oaks' return to competition surfaced again. He had been training with feverish intensity for 7 weeks at Santa Monica's World Gym. After 3 years of political infighting among the studio bosses, production for the long-awaited $15 million film Conan the Barbarian was underway. The film's star was needed the kind of condition that brought him his ego-soothing string of 6 Mr. Olympia titles. Within a few weeks, Arnold's body was firming up and growing at an alarming rate. It was almost changing its form before the very eyes of the men who trained around him every morning. A week before the biggest bodybuilding contest ever, some $50,000 in prize money, people close to the scene were talking seriously of a last-second entrant, Arnold himself. He was 85% a week ago, photographer John Balick told us, en route to Sydney 6 days before the event. He hasn't looked this good since he retired. He's 225 and cut. Ken Waller, back from retirement himself, had his own theory about Arnold competing. Just think about this. First place this year is $20,000. Arnold's got to be getting at least that for doing the color commentary for CBS. What's he going to do? Come back, risk losing and destroying the legend? Or just sit back and announce on TV for the same money? He's in good shape, but not like he used to be. People don't remember how he really was. The day before the contest was depressingly bleak and quiet in Sydney. The bodybuilders, great head-turning attractions to the awe-stricken souls of Bondi Beach, withdrew to the security of their hotel rooms, from which emanated the pungent odor of suntan. Every set in Bondi's Cosmopolitan Inn was tuned to the Muhammad Ali-Larry Holmes title fight beamed live from Las Vegas. Mike Mentzer, Boyer Coe, Danny Padilla, Ken Waller, all of bodybuilding's best sat in the privacy of their rooms watching the world's most famous man reeling from the club-like jab of his attacker, make the biggest mistake of his life, go for the last hurrah. Across Sydney, amid the palatial comfort of his Hilton suite, Arnold also viewed the carnage on his TV screen, and with more than a little interest. How often has he been called the Muhammad Ali of bodybuilding? The outcome of this fight had a special significance to him. On the eve of his return from 5 years of bodybuilding idleness, Arnold's mind began to compose an unpleasant scenario. With each punch Holmes ripped into the puffy mess that was Ali's face, Arnold winced, not out of sympathy for the boxer, but for the imagined vision of a similar fate at the hands of his opponents the next day. Arnold would talk of the fight later. You hear the stories of old guys, the former champs, coming back and getting wiped out by the new guys, and it was happening to Ali right before my eyes. Just like me, he decided to come back one more time. I could see he was making a mistake, and for a split second, I had to wonder if I'd be making the same mistake by entering the Olympia the next day. Would I be risking my legend? But it was only for a split second. The thing that got Ali and me where we are is that our decisions are gut reactions. They're instinctive. Suddenly, boom, it's there. It's as if a higher power took over your mind. So you go after whatever you're after 100%. I never questioned my competing. If I had, I would have realized it was a very dangerous thing to do. One of the judges, Belgium's Jacques Bloemhart, was aware of that danger the morning before the Olympia. He saw Arnold training in the gym and later that day told us, "I saw him. Nothing. People who don't know how he used to look are impressed, but he just doesn't have it. He shouldn't enter this contest. It'll be a mistake. I remember when his pecs were so monstrous you could stand underneath them in the rain and not get wet. His chest was like a shelf over your head." But Bloemhart was one of the few to see Arnold before the contest. Certainly none of the other 15 competitors were aware of Arnold's condition. Most of them didn't even know he'd be competing. Some didn't care. "I'm sick of hearing all this Arnold competing talk," contender Mike Mentzer told us that dismal day of Ali's demise. "I couldn't care less if he enters. But I'll tell you one thing, what a feather in my cap to beat Arnold, if he enters." There was no small number of people who thought Mentzer could do it, too. After placing second to three-time champ Frank Zane the year before, Mentzer vowed 1980 would be his year. He trained with savage intensity, beginning his Spartan regimen almost 6 months before the battle. Unlike the previous year, Mentzer entered no other contest, saving his efforts for the big one, the Sydney Olympia. In the course of his training, he added an incredible 10 pounds of muscle since his first Olympia in 79, and it didn't take an expert's eye to see that he had equaled, if not surpassed, the level of definition and muscularity he had amazed observers with before. 3 months before the contest, Mentzer read an alarming passage written by Arnold in Muscle Mag International. In a near malicious attack on Mentzer, Arnold wrote that his rival did not possess even a world-class physique, and that the Olympia was one title that would forever elude him. This from a man who at the time was slated to be a judge at one of the most important contests of Mentzer's life. "How can Arnold possibly judge me objectively after making comments such as these?" Mentzer wanted to know at the time the attack was published. Indeed, there was no denying the fact that Arnold saw Mentzer as an upstart, a parvenu, a person who had suddenly gained status and wealth in the sport by way of a formidable physique and a superior intellect. Arnold saw Mentzer as a threat to his lofty position as the sport's king. The threat may have been very real, for it was Mentzer who, in his training seminars explaining his revolutionary heavy-duty system, often pointed to the fallacies of the 20-plus sets per body part, the very methods that catapulted Arnold to the top. If you can achieve the physique of Arnold by using his training system, why aren't there more Arnolds running around? Mentzer often asked his students. Surprisingly, such criticism of Arnold's training was taken personally by Arnold. He would carry a grudge a long time. After the Olympia, defending champ Frank Zane would ask Arnold why he came back to compete, and Arnold would tell him to get back at Mentzer and Boyer Coe to show them they can't get away with knocking me in my training. Arnold would admit to saying this later, "Yes, at first that was one of the reasons why I wanted to compete. The game is too small to knock each other. I wanted to show Mentzer and Coe that you could go into the Olympia on a very positive note without criticizing others and win. That was my motivation at first, But finally, it meant nothing to me. Zane had reason to believe Arnold had it in for him, too. After his 1979 victory in Columbus, Zane was asked by Arnold on nationwide TV how it felt to win a third Olympia. The former school teacher stunned his interviewer when he replied, "Great, Arnold, almost as good as the time I beat you in 68. One does not do that to the Austrian Oak and escape the consequences. In retrospect, Zane is convinced of that. There were those who wondered why Zane, too, would risk his standing in the sport for a fourth title shot. He had nothing to gain and everything to lose. As his preparations for the contest unfolded, things began to going awry. There were warnings of defeat that he wouldn't heed. While tanning at the poolside of his Palm Springs home, Zane suffered a freak accident when the chair he was sitting in collapsed. The accident sent him to the hospital for 8 days with internal bleeding. I knew I had my accident that something was wrong with this contest, he said later. It was off to a bad start, and I should have stayed out. It was a warning I didn't heed. Then there was Boyer Coe, the other target of Arnold's wrath. He had never felt better about his chances for victory. Some 10 pounds heavier this time, he shocked observers in Paul Graham's gym in Sydney with his advanced muscularity. He talked about his attitude 2 days before the contest while basking in the glorious Australian sunshine. I feel great. Jet lag is no problem with me. I've done a lot of travel, and this contest is just too important to let feeling tired affect me. I've been having terrific workouts since I arrived. I'm in the best shape I've ever been in, heavier and harder. I injured my shoulder after the 1979 Canada Cup, and it lingered for a few months. I trained around it. Then June 1st, the first day of my Olympia preparation, it started to improve. I began handling heavier weights and doing less sets. Every workout was better than the last. And before long, I was simply in the best shape of my life. I feel very confident about this contest. I have it all together. I'm not nervous at all. It's pointless to get nervous now. If you aren't ready when you get on the plane to come over here, you'll never be ready. Chris Dickerson knew that. When he made the 18-hour flight from Los Angeles with the rest of the bodybuilding superstars, he was quietly confident of victory. He had maintained the form that won him the vaunted Grand Prix title of 1980. He had entered no less than six contests, and each time out, he was in his best possible shape. Dickerson and Zane maintained the lowest profiles in the days leading up to the contest. Upon his arrival at the Sydney airport, Zane was immediately and almost mysteriously spirited away to a private residence. He would remain incognito until the morning of the contest. Dickerson, after an evening at the Cosmopolitan Inn, where the majority of the competitors stayed, made tracks downtown to the more comfortable environs of the Hilton. Dennis Tinerino did the same. Tinerino had a lot riding on this contest. His manager, Ken Mears, had invested a great deal of money in him. Both men held very high hopes. They had good reason. Only a week before, Joe Weider raved about the transplanted Brooklynite's super muscular condition. There was, in the opinion of some, the very real chance that Tinerino would win his first Olympia. Other bodybuilders shared those ambitions. Only a few had shown up in less than top condition. For all of the competitors, the one thought that was uppermost in their minds as they went to bed that Olympia Eve was, "Tomorrow is my day." Each of them would be in for a very large disappointment. Tomorrow would be nobody's day but Arnold's. There's something indescribable about the electric excitement of an Olympia morning, and the hours leading up to it, sleep, if it comes at all, is punctuated by a fluctuation between a half-dream state and the foggy awareness that something of great importance is imminent. Yet no one who has experienced the adrenaline-fueled high of an Olympia morning ever rises from that shallow sleep tired. Dawn broke quickly Saturday, October 4th, in Sydney. The sky was clear. Most of the competitors were awake with anticipation by the time the sun ascended from the watery horizon east of Bondi Beach. For Mike Mentzer, there was still much to be done in preparation for the prejudging, scheduled for 2 p.m. The training for this, his second Olympia, had been a devastating ordeal that had left him huge and defined, but tired beyond exhaustion. He had said days before the contest, "I like bodybuilding, but I like living better. I'm never putting my mind and body through this hell again." There was no sign of his fatigue Olympia morning. The day before, he had been concerned about a small amount of water he was holding subcutaneously. As a means of ridding himself of the bothersome fluid, Mentzer borrowed a rubber sweatsuit from Samir Banute. Wearing that and a regular cotton jogging suit, he locked himself in the kitchen of his hotel room. Then he turned on the oven and stove full blast, creating a sauna effect of awesome intensity. To make sure that he'd be completely dehydrated, the perspiring giant endured 45 minutes of this. The sweat literally cascaded from every pore until there was a large puddle that on the linoleum floor. Throughout this ordeal, Mensur kept swallowing potassium tablets to prevent his muscles from becoming too drained. While he was anxious to purge himself of the water beneath his skin, he needed the water in the muscles to keep his size at a maximum. Potassium would do that. Little did Mensur know, on the same day, Arnold subjected himself to a similar ritual. Indeed, Arnold's need to free himself from his cloak of water was so desperate, he went through his posing routine no less than 50 times. Why was he holding water? Before leaving for Australia, Arnold had taken a cortisone shot to ease the pain of a shoulder injury and allow him to continue training. A side effect of the shot was extreme water retention. As an extra precaution, Mensur sat in his makeshift sauna the morning of the Olympia. It was then that a very excited Samir called the room. It seems in his own bizarre way of shedding subcutaneous water, Samir took a Lasix tablet, a very strong and sometimes unpredictable diuretic, and not only promotes a veritable Niagara of urine, but dangerously steals the body of its minerals, particularly potassium. And that's bad news for the heart. That was exactly the news Samir was frantically telling Mensur. His heart was in the throes of an arrhythmic tap dance. On Mensur's advice, we were dispatched immediately to Samir's room with a handful of potassium tablets. A scared but grateful Samir answered the door. Within minutes, his crisis had passed. Poor Samir. There was a man who had been preoccupied with losing water for nearly a month. The Lebanese lion is going to be on the atomic bomb in Australia, he boasted on the flight over. I'm holding a little water now, but as soon as I lose it, look out. During a stopover at the Honolulu International Airport, while everyone was trying to catch a few winks in a mostly uncomfortable environment, Samir quietly stole away to a public washroom, where in the hope of sweating more water, he posed before a mirror for 30 minutes. When someone asked of his whereabouts, John Balik replied, "He's in the washroom trying to squeeze out a little more water." We laughed. Samir's personal crusade to break the bondage of H2O had become a bit of a joke among certain members of our entourage. Mensur said, "I've been hearing about this water for 8 months. I'm waiting to see him lose it." "Well, he's oceans away," your reporter responded. It would not be the last of the puns concerning Samir's water. Flying back to Los Angeles, Samir expressed dismay over his puffy, waterlogged condition at the contest. "If I only had a few more days of sweating," he lamented, "it would have been different." Again, we could not resist needling the hapless rookie. "Samir, it means nothing now. It's all water under the bridge." The following conversation between two fellows was overheard in an elevator of the Cosmopolitan Inn 2 hours before the prejudging. "So you figure Arnold will get blown off the stage?" "Yeah, he's making a mistake this time, just like Ali. He's not going up against the jerks he used to. I think Mensur will destroy him." There was an air of great importance as all the competitors, judges, officials, and various parties with finger on the pulse of the game assembled in a poorly lit, low-ceilinged room deep in the carpeted catacombs below the famous Sydney Opera House. An ultimatum in the form of a petition had been put before IFBB President Ben Weider and Chief Judge Bill Pearl. He would not judge that day. It read, "The following Mr. Olympia competitors are in favor of abolishing two weight classes under and over 200 pounds and replacing them with one open class. The signatures of all the competitors were scrawled beneath, all competitors except Arnold." The message in the petition was implicit: one class or no contest. The potentially explosive situation had to be diffused. Pearl took control. "I'm not the man to make the decision, but someone here will have to," he told us. "I'm not saying Arnold's right or Arnold's wrong, but something must be done to satisfy the 15 other bodybuilders." Then Pearl, who had nobly removed himself from the judging panel because he had spent time at his Oregon ranch coaching Chris Dickerson, struck a blow for the petitioners. "If we keep two classes, do we really know the best six men will be the finalists?" Heads nodded. That was the crux of the problem. If the top three from each class were picked to form the six finalists, who was to say the fourth place man in the under 200-pound class wasn't better than any of the other over 200-pound class competitors, or vice versa? Boyer Coe, who spearheaded the drive for one class, called upon the one bodybuilder who opposed the change. It would be the last of common courtesy we'd see that morning. Arnold was given the floor. He would not surrender it before things turned ugly. "The reason I want to keep classes," Arnold began, "is because when the Olympia was started in 1965, we did have one class. Everybody competed against everybody else. And for years it was that way. Then the shorter men complained they weren't getting a fair chance because they had to go head to head with the big guys right from the start. So in 1974, we changed to two classes to protect the small man. What's the sense of changing back? Are we going to change every time someone doesn't like the rules? But Arnold, Coe tried to respond, but Arnold, as we said, had the floor. Condescending was the tone of his Bavarian bark. Excuse me, Boyer, let's talk like adults here and let me finish, okay? The hostility in Arnold's eyes fairly leapt at his stunned competitor. The same anger would surface again. I just don't see what the big deal is, Arnold continued. The purpose of this contest is to pick the number one bodybuilder in the world. Not second, not third. No matter how many classes we've had, the best man has always won. All that matters is the winner. It was a viewpoint no one else in the room shared. A voice from the assemblage sounded out. Not all of us can win the Olympia, so it is important to know where we stand. Some of us would like to know how we compare. This humble plea was not without its silent message, too. Placings are crucial. They're needed for the allocation of prize money. Every man in the room knew this. Money is as much the bottom line as is first place. Arnold was unbending in his attitude. We aren't here to pick second. We're here to pick first. Why change to one class? It was Menser's turn to enter the fray. Besides the fact that everybody but one guy wants one class, it's obvious that running a contest with just one group as opposed to two is a lot faster and easier. Arnold, if there's a better, more efficient way, why not change? And then, as if a straight question were not deserving of a straight answer, Arnold's true contempt for his rival flowed forth with the following irrelevant remark. Mike Menser, we all know Zane beat you last year because you have a big stomach. The room froze, save Menser, who rose defiantly from his seat 20 feet from his attacker. There was more on his mind than just words. You're the one who said we should talk like adults, and you bring it down to this personal level, Menser snapped as he approached Arnold, finger pointing menacingly. Before Arnold's lean face could be turned into gory pulp, Ben Weider moved swiftly to intercept Menser. In a moment, sure violence was averted. Arnold turned away smugly. Menser took his seat beside companion Kathy Gelfo, who, if she were so blessed with the strength, would have single-handedly torn Arnold's head from the massive body that held it high. Bodybuilding had just taken a quantum leap backward. The debate continued with minor players. It was then Joe Weider's turn to lend his calm influence. He pulled Arnold aside and said, "Why wreck the whole contest for everyone if the best man's going to win anyway?" As quickly as Arnold brought the meeting to the edge of violence, he allayed the tension with a tense, "Joe just said something to me and I agree with him. Why should I spoil it for 15 guys? I withdraw my objection." "The IFBB is here to protect the bodybuilder," Ben Weider said, trying to appeal to the jangled senses of the congregation. "And we are here to see that the rules are uniform. So under extreme circumstances, we're making the change to one class here in the best interest of the bodybuilders." Arnold needed the last word. He walked over to Ben, shook his hand, and said sardonically, "I want to thank you, Ben, for your support, and I want to prove one way or the other the best man will win tonight." As a diplomatic gesture to Arnold, Ben called for a round of applause. Most hands remained still. The damage had been done. Before the meeting adjourned, Bill Pearl asked the competitors if there were any complaints concerning the judges. Reg Park, Mitz Kawashima, Albert Busack, Dan Howard, Brendan Ryan, Jacques Blumhardt, and Mike Walczak. No one uttered a peep. Not then, anyway. As this is being written, a full month since the physically reincarnated Arnold Schwarzenegger, with a mere 8 weeks of training invested in history's most famous body, strode cockily on stage and added one more Olympia title to his superfluous string of six. A full month and still not settled was the emotional dust sent high from what one vanquished competitor described as the most outrageous decision in the history of bodybuilding. To the furious 15, united in the belief that the wrong man won, the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest remains a bitter pill lodged uncomfortably in the gullet. To the Austrian Oak, his most recent victory was just a day a month ago. Now my mind's on other projects. The instant Arnold stepped on stage with his 15 opponents, it was apparent to this reporter that he had made a mistake. Arnold himself would later tell us, "Look, I know I was only in 90% shape. I could look in the mirror and see that. I couldn't fool myself." Arnold at 90% is a formidable sight indeed. The biceps are peaked and mighty. The chest is full and imposing. But Arnold at 90% is 10% less than his best. And that gives breathing room to his weaknesses. Slender thighs, undeveloped triceps and deltoids, and a mediocre midsection. All those flaws detracted from the package in a most unflattering way. And in the opinion of this reporter, Arnold's weaknesses only serve to strengthen the incredible condition of the men who look better. Chris Dickerson, Boyer Coe, and Mike Menser. There are those who would put Frank Zane in that group. In order of appearance, here's how they looked. Number one, Danny Padilla. If and when the Giant Killer ever decides to really put it all together, we will see, in spite of his height, the first Puerto Rican Mr. Olympia. In Australia, Danny had his usual beautiful shape and mass, but because of a week-long bout with hemorrhoids and diarrhea, the smoky-eyed fire plug was anything but ripped. Two, Boyer Coe. No one thought he could improve upon his astonishing condition of 1979, but he did. And how? Boyer was absolutely out of this world. For the first time, he weighed more than 200 pounds, and he was almost two cut. His posing routine to Rocky II was one of the finest ever. He has a repertoire of poses, mostly arm shots, that's beyond compare. Three, Roy Duvall. The first Olympia for the Briton, he had a very well-proportioned physique, and his posing to Emerson, Lake, and Palmer's version of Fanfare for the Common Man was stirring, but he looked too puffy to be a threat. Four, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I've long been one of the Oak's most vocal fans. In the history of bodybuilding, only one man can compare with Arnold, Sergio Oliva. But Arnold had the smarts to easily handle the Cuban. Regardless of how highly I regarded Arnold in the past, the 34-year-old just didn't look like number one that day in Sydney. His posing had the leonine grace and power, but it seemed uninspired and old hat. It's a mystery to me how Arnold could command a perfect 100 score in the mandatory posing round. To score perfectly, one would have to be perfect in each pose. Regardless of the fact that Arnold neglected to do some of the compulsory poses, those he did do showed he needed another 2, maybe 3 weeks of training to be considered the best on that stage. Five, Roger Walker. Unquestionably the most improved bodybuilder in the contest. Thick and striated beyond description, this hometown favorite drew, understandably, the biggest ovation of the day. Walker is very definitely Mr. Olympia material. Six, Roy Callender. The biggest man in the contest, no one sports more muscle than this Montreal resident. But alas, he wasn't in the diamond hard condition we've seen him in before, and he was quickly relegated to next year country. He would narrowly lose a tie with Walker. Seven, Mike Mentzer. What can be said about a colossus who scored a perfect 300 in 1979 and looked even better in 1980? It's inconceivable that bodybuilding's most intelligent practitioner can get any larger. But the detail was there this time. He may have had the best midriff in the whole affair. Eight, Tony Emmett. This hardworking, quiet Yorkshire man had some real bum decisions before, but this time he looked a little overtrained. His back was still one of the best I've seen. Nine, Ken Waller. He wouldn't have competed had he not told Paul Graham, the promoter, 8 months before that he'd be there. This was not the real Ken Waller. He was huge, but fat went out with Louis Cyr. 10, Samir Banout. Who has better shape and symmetry? Samir is probably the greatest young contender, and the title is very definitely within his reach, but he was a good 2 weeks away from being cut. Water wasn't his problem, it was fat. 11, Frank Zane. It's a miracle the defending champ got into the shape he did, considering the severity of his injury in Palm Springs. He was the most defined man on stage, but it was obvious he was playing catch-up following his setback. He just didn't have the muscle size to pull it off. His posing to Pink Floyd was surpassed only by the next competitor. 12, Chris Dickerson. Coming off his impressive string of Grand Prix victories, Chris couldn't have looked more polished and tighter. So passionate was his posing to Dionne Warwick's Never Love This Way Again that even his staunchest rivals were prompted to elicit praise. The only man other than Arnold to receive first-place votes in the final pose-down. 13, Dennis Tenorino. The pre-contest hoopla in favor of the big Italian was considerable. A lot of people, after seeing him in the weeks leading up to the contest, were certain Dennis was the man to beat. And he was great, very tight, but he still needs work in too many areas. 14, Tom Platz. Worked maniacally year-round to bring his upper body almost up to par with the best legs in the sport. And he was ripped. Made his presence felt in a very positive way. Give him a few years. 15, Casey Viator. More was expected of this monster, but there are few men with more muscle than this Cajun, but you can't win a thing if you can't see the physique for the fat. He'll be back. One of the few guys capable of winning this title. 16, Ed Corney. Last but not least, when you're 47 years old, just showing up on stage and holding your own against men young enough to be your sons is a victory of sorts. Still has the formidable development, and you can't pose better than Ed. You can only do it differently. Too puffy this time. And here's how they finished. One, Schwarzenegger, 300 points. Two, Dickerson, 292. Zane, third, 291. Coe fourth, 280. Menser fifth, 278. Walker sixth, 277. Callender seventh, 277. Eighth, Tenorino. Nine, Platts. Tenth, Padilla. 11th, Corny. 12th, Emmett. 13th, Duval. 14th, Viator. 15th, Benute. 16th, Waller. Something started to smell when Mike Menser was announced as the fifth place finisher. How is it that the Menser of 1979 could score a perfect 300 and 1 year later, with 10 pounds more muscle and even tighter skin, score a mere 278? Fifth place? The judges had to be joking. So ludicrous was the decision, Menser said later, that really all I could do was laugh. I'll tell you, somebody out there really wanted me crushed out completely. Well, that's it for me. That's the last time I'm going through that kind of training for that kind of shit decision. No one can tell me I wasn't in the best shape of my life. My bodybuilding career is over. Bodybuilding just lost what could have been its best spokesman. If only I'd been given the chance. Boyer Coe's immediate reaction to fourth, again, who's kidding whom, was less civilized than Menser's appraisal of his own placing. Is there no justice? The enraged Coe demanded to know as he sent chairs flying into walls. Indeed, Coe's response was reminiscent of Dickens, who wrote in Great Expectations, "There's nothing so finely perceived and so finely felt as injustice." Zane at first accepted third with a calmer demeanor. Shortly after, however, he shattered his trophy into hundreds of pieces by hurling it to the asphalt of the Opera House parking lot. Dickerson accepted second place with a sharp, "Oh no," backstage, and after a curt smile on stage, he vanished into the night minutes later. It was a very big letdown, he would admit later. Arnold, of course, received his placing with a tad more enthusiasm. "I can't believe it," he roared backstage. "Seven times. I can't believe it." But with the announcement of Arnold's triumph in the words of John Milton, all hell broke loose. For the first time in his heralded career, Arnold was booed by approximately 40% of the more than 2,000 fans who filled the posh seats of the Opera House. "Of course, I'd rather have no booing," he confided afterwards, "but I didn't come to worry about boos. I came to win. No decision is ever 100% popular." All 15 competitors are unanimous in their belief that selecting Arnold as 1980 Mr. Olympia was a bad decision on part of the judges. They aren't alone in that opinion. The CBS sports crew on hand to cover the contest expressed shock at the results. They had, in anticipation of their predicted outcome, interviewed only two men backstage, Arnold, because he is, after all, Arnold, and Menser, the man they saw as the champion. Even Bill Pearl, known for his integrity as the IFBB's chief judge, said later, "I sure as hell wouldn't have picked Arnold." In the wake of his victory, Arnold is not pleased about the outcry from his colleagues. So strong are the feelings about the decision, a cabal of competitors, led by Frank Zhang, Mike Menser, and Boyer Coe, boycotted Arnold's Pro Mr. Universe contest November 1st in Columbus, Ohio. "The old camaraderie of bodybuilding is gone," said Arnold. "People are now counting on contest money so much that when they don't get it, they get mad and call fix. The money aspect is ruining the game. In 1975, I said, wouldn't it be great if a bodybuilder could make a living just by competing? I have to go back on that. It's sad so many competitors have to rely on a sixth place finish in a contest to survive. And it's strange that a money-oriented man like me would be saying this. Money creates fights and greed. I trained for this contest with a joy. I didn't care about the money." So what was it that moved him to compete? "Well, I've been training hard for the film, and as the weeks passed, my training partner, Franco Colombo, kept saying, 'Arnold, the Olympia's coming up. You must go into it and shock everybody.' At first, I resisted, but I began working it over in my mind, and I was hooked. I was getting bigger, and it felt terrific. So I sat down with my girlfriend, Maria Shriver. She told me not to compete, that the other guys respected me for going out on top. I could blow it. And I agreed with her, but this force within me kept telling me to compete. Maria said if I had so much excess energy, I should learn Spanish, because the film's being shot near Madrid. But I said, I cannot let it go. Then one night she stopped, said that she'd given me reasons not to compete, but if I wanted to compete, she would support me. She's a powerhouse. She was the one who kept tearing the ice cream away from me." Answering the claims of poor judging, Arnold points out that all competitors were asked if they approved the panel. "No one said a thing. I'm friendly with nearly every judge around, but the way the judges see a contest lineup has nothing to do with a personal friendship. It's a whole new ballgame." Zane, Menser, Tenorino, Callender, and Coe, who are few of as of October 4th, are looking for a whole new ballgame. All have talked about retirement. Welcome to the 80s. All right. There was Jack Neary's long article about the Mr. Olympia. And of course, Jack was a good friend of Mike Mentzer, so it might have been a little biased, but he also was a friend of Arnold, at least back in the day he was. And Jack was a great writer. So that was the first article that came out about the controversy of the Olympia. And like I said, it's kind of a famous article that people still refer to today. I know John Little is writing a book about Mike Mentzer's bodybuilding career, and he's definitely looking at that article as a reference. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed the articles. Hope you enjoyed our interview with Jerry. And we'll be back next week for part three of our interview with Jerry, where we talk about the Lee Haney era and then all the eras following the Mr. Olympia after that, going all the way up to the present day, where they'll be celebrating the 60th Mr. Olympia this year. So we'll be back next week for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to our Patreon donors who keep supporting the show. If you guys are interested in becoming a Patreon donor yourself, you can go to our website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link to becoming a Patreon donor, or just check out the link in the description below. Until then, guys, we'll see you next week. Take care, train hard, and we'll see you next week. Take care.